listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming on the web at kfai.org. I'm Liz Olds. Tonight on Right on Radio, David will be talking with Randy Llewellyn, the author of Maroons, A Human Epic, and Maroons, The Journey. The first two parts of a sci-fi trilogy that tells the dramatic story of a few humans who survive a global pandemic, only to find that they have to somehow rebuild a civilization of fear, distrust, violence, and love. While at work in part three of Maroons, Randy resided in the winter in South Dakota, where he still sometimes straps on the tool belt and engages in his lifetime craft of masonry.
And I'm Josh Weber.
In the last part of the show, Liz talks with Robert Dugoni, the best-selling and critically acclaimed author of The Extraordinary Life of Sam Hell. His latest work, The World Played Chess, is a story of two friends in the 70s, one who went to Vietnam and one who didn't. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
Welcome back to Right on Radio. I'm Dave Fettig, your host for this segment. And joining us this evening is Randy Llewellyn. Randy, welcome.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks for letting me come on your show.
Absolutely. We're thrilled to have you. Randy is the author of a trilogy in the works. It's a sci-fi trilogy. The first two volumes are out there in the world. Take a look. It's Maroons, A Human Epic, and Maroons, The Journey, third volume to come out. I'll let Randy finish that sentence. Randy, when's the third volume coming out?
Well, it's at the editor right now, and she's up to chapter 13, and it has quite a few chapters in it,
okay.
The third one. And I have a lot of confidence in her. I think it'll be out hopefully by the end of the year. I don't know.
Wonderful. That's wonderful. It's a compelling story set in contemporary times, but yet in future times. Randy, why don't you give us a broad story arc of what we're dealing with Maroons, and then I have a number of questions. We'll get to as many as we can, and a little bit of a reading. So tell us, let's back up. We've had this chat before live on the radio. How did this come to you, this story?
Well, I call it a download, Dave. I was lost in the jungle, hiking on the island of Dominica in the Caribbean, and I've chosen to, with my girlfriend, we climbed the highest peak, which few people do. There's a trail, if you can call it that, and we stashed our packs way down below, headed to the top, and on the way down we got hopelessly lost. I mean, hopeless. And we ended up spending the night out in the forest. It was quite magical. But anyway, when having been on the island, we had visited a fort there. It was built by the English, yeah, way back in the 1700s. And it was a fascinating story. And then on the mountain, this download came down for this book. I don't know how to explain it.
I love it. Yeah. I've heard authors talk about that they didn't find the story, the story found them. And that's what sounds like happened to you.
Yeah, exactly. And the first chapter of the Maroons is actually a real story that really happened. I just made up the names and filled in the characters.
Nice.
And so that's where it all begins. And that's just for people to understand really what a Maroon is. I mean, the Maroons were escaped slaves that went into the forest and established their own communities, and they couldn't find them. They were so deep in the jungle, and they kept so hidden. And so that's where I came up with the title Maroons. Mm-hmm. And it fit real well, because it's, imagine if you will, Dave, a diabolical plot by somebody and it goes hopelessly wrong, yeah. Wipes out majority of the human race.
Yeah.
And you're one that's left.
Randy, I'm going to stop you right there, because when I read this, it's compelling on many levels, but also we've just gone through a pandemic. We still are in the middle of a pandemic, or maybe coming out of it, whatever the case might be. But, you know, you read something like that, a sci-fi sort of premise, and you think, okay, yeah, that'll never happen. But indeed, it can certainly happen. And it's a virus, right?
It's a man-made virus. And I've actually had people come up to me and say, what are you, a prophet or something?
Yeah, yeah.
and I go, no, I'm not. I'm not a prophet. And I hope to God this never happens. Right. But it is the creation of diabolical people and the aftermath. But what's really more important is it those people that survived. I mean, how you have to think about, how would you deal with, yeah, creating a new society, if you will, knowing what the society that you left behind, what would you do? How would you change it? Well, how would you make it different? And that is kind of what this is all about. And then it takes an even greater twist when human beings, I don't want to give it away.
No, but, I know.
But, yeah. But the virus has an impact, not just to kill people, but it changes people.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to go too much into that, but the way people change and I don't know how to explain, but I've been able to do a lot of things with this story. The first book is basically the cataclysmic act and the people, the gathering of these people and what happens. And some of them wipe out each other. I mean, it's very realistic.
Yeah.
The second book, I've been toying with it, kind of a different theory of spirituality, not too far different than what is, but it leaves out certain aspects of most spiritual beliefs. And I got to thinking, should I write a book about it? And my wife said, why don't you put it in story form?
Yeah.
And so the second book, The Journey, is basically, I'm actually continuing the same story, but I'm throwing in this theory of the way to look at the world. And I don't know, I'm very proud of it. And then the third book, of course, is, go ahead.
Well, I'll tell you, by setting yourself up for this story, you could have gotten away with just writing the first volume, or even taking some edge off the first volume and just giving us this cataclysmic story and how some few people survive, and then let it drop, kind of like a sci-fi movie. But what you've taken upon yourself to do, Randy, which I admire you for, is to do what you said earlier, which is to try to describe, in effect, build a model for how people could rebuild civilization, in effect, and how different groups of people react to these extreme situations, what type of ideas take hold, what type of ideas work better than others. It's I admire you for taking it on.
But Dave, I'll tell you what, no matter who survives and what have you, we still have to deal with being hopelessly human.
Yeah.
And all the things that trip us up now are there to trip us up then. And how do people deal with that? And maybe they don't, and maybe it gets worse, or maybe it never gets better. Maybe things stay the same, but in my book, hopefully it moves in more of a better direction.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to ask you to do a little reading, Randy. We'd like to do that for our listeners to get a sense for the style of the author and your voice. But before we do that, I want to talk about Randy as Randy in this story. I've had the pleasure of getting to know you a little bit and hope to get to know you even better in the future. But we tend to do this when we read stories about people we know, where they fit in here. And are you Welsh, Randy?
Yes, of course. Yeah, yeah, very, well, very much.
Very much. I thought so with the name. And Welsh shows up in here. I'm not going to try to pronounce this wonderful phrase. Go ahead and tell me how to pronounce it.
Ficarity.
Ficarity. I'm going to write a phonetic spelling. So
Ficarity. It means I'm loving you.
Ah, yes. When did you decide to bring that in? I guess, well, another way to ask that question is these idea of Welsh stories or mythology or legend, and you pull from so many different streams, if you will. Where do I want to go with this question? What was sort of your guiding idea when you were dreaming this one up?
Well, Dave, all the characters in my book, I use people that I knew for those characters. I use their names. I use some of their attributes, maybe some of their physical characteristics. It helped me remember them better. And when you talk about Wales, I went to school in Wales.
Oh, wow.
And learned a little bit of the language. I mean, that's my roots. And the gal that I was on this hike with, her name was Sue. And she's kind of the main character in the book, as you probably figured out.
Yeah.
She was also with me when we went and we did a walk across Wales. It's called the Cleaver y Gwyndŵr. It means Gwyndŵr's way. And it's a path across Wales. And you just go from little town to little town. You don't even carry a backpack. And you know, there's always a meal and a bed and breakfast wherever you go. And so I learned a lot on that trip. And
I wrote that one down. I'm gonna look that one up, Randy.
Cleaver y Gwyndŵr?
Yes, I'm gonna look that one up.
I better spell it for you. Cleaver is spelled two double L.
Yep.
W Y B R. The Welsh don't use a lot of vowels. and two L's is a CL sound.
Okay.
Gwyndŵr is Glendur. Okay. And he rebelled against the British, and of course they ended up killing him. Sure. But it's called Glendur's Way. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful thing to do, and I've often thought about going back and doing another Welsh walk like that. Anyway, that's so Wales came into it big time.
Say, Randy, give us a little taste for your writing.
Okay.
I know you have a reading selected for us. And set us.
Yes, I do.
Set the reading up for us so we know what we're.
Okay.
Where we are.
Now, this comes out of book number 2, okay. Maroons the Journey. And basically, it includes all the characters from the first book plus some, but primarily it follows two characters that weren't in the first book. And they're two men. RK is an old Vietnam vet who came back from the Tet Offensive and went to Woodstock and met Desiree, the love of his life. And they became toured the country in a VW van and did everything that hippies did back then.
Right.
And they decided to find an isolated place from society because they pretty much had enough with government and things that had gone on, what have you. And so they ended up in Montana. Well, Desiree doesn't survive the plague, but RK does. And in the midst of it, he finds this baby, this newborn baby in the midst of the plague that also survives. And so he raises this child for 20 years. And he doesn't know if there is any survivors. And he's looked around Montana, but not very far because he has a baby.
Right.
And at some point he decides they need to find other survivors. There must be somebody else out there. And so he And Justin, the name of the baby, who basically he's known only RK as his father. Mm-hmm. And these guys look like a couple of mountain men out of the 1820s. And they have all those characteristics. They look like it. They've learned to adapt. They're avid hunters, what have you. Yeah. And they're on horseback and they're traveling from city to city looking for survivors. And in this particular chapter, and throughout it all, RK is explaining to Justin this spiritual theory that he's come up with. Gotcha. And Justin is always asking questions about the before time because he sees massive buildings and things and relics and things left over, no people, but he has all these questions. Yeah. And so this particular chapter takes place there in Mendocino County, California. And they have, of course, come across massive fields of the herb that are growing wild. And RK takes him back to the old hippie days. And then he's happy there. And he's kind of locked in and saying, well, maybe we'll just stay here. And this is in that chapter.
Great.
Justin had become a fine hunter and an excellent shot. He could move silently through the thickest forest, something RK never mastered. Justin obliged the old man, telling him the process in vivid detail, down to the smell in the air and the look in the animal's eye. He's talking about an elk that he had killed. Mm-hmm. After their meal, they lit up the pipe with the sacred herb and imbibed. Justin looked over and asked, "Father, why doesn't the herb grow in our home in Montana?" "It can and does, but it was forbidden in the before time, and few grew it," RK responded. "Forbidden? How can such a wonderful thing be forbidden, Justin asked, said. "We would put people in things called jails and punish them if they were caught growing or smoking it. There were many laws and rules. So many I cannot remember," RK returned. Justin looked at this man he respected for a long time. "How could you let them do that, Father?" he spoke almost accusingly. RK sat a long time and finally responded, "I did let them do it, son. We all did. It's hard to explain. Do you remember how I told you how there was so much lying?" Justin shook his head. RK continued, "Do you remember how I told you that all experience comes from either love or fear?" Justin nodded again. RK grimaced. "Lying comes from fear. And there was so much fear. Fear permeated our society. It destroyed the things that mean the most in love, freedom." RK moved closer to the fire and gazed into it. "Those that loved freedom were far fewer than those that were consumed with fear. In the end, I think it was fear that caused the event that killed everyone." After a long pause, Justin spoke. "Father, what were they afraid of? What were you afraid of?" RK turned to look at Justin as if he had done something amazing and blew out through his nose when something clear had dawned on him. "We were afraid of difference, different from what we believed, from what we were used to, losing control, new ideas. The list is endless. I was afraid too, afraid of what could be taken from me, especially my freedom. That is why Desiree and I went to live in such a remote place, away from everyone else, all the lies and stories we made up." RK stood up and stretched his arms wide and looked up into the stars in the sky. "This is it, my son, this life. We waste it when we live in fear. We forget to live and at best prepare the earth so that our progeny could live even better. We failed our descendants." RK let his arms drop to his side. "I must not fail you. Tomorrow we head south and continue our search for survivors. I love you, son." Justin rose up and embraced the old man as he broke into tears.
Thank you. That was Randy Llewellyn, Llewellyn, reading from the second volume of his trilogy, Maroons, The Journey. The first volume is Maroons, A Human Epic, and the third volume is forthcoming. Look him up, Randy Llewellyn. Randy, that was a beautiful passage. So much there to talk about, living in fear, my goodness. And like all good sci-fi, it speaks to us in the present. Randy, I want to ask you about nature. There's a beautiful nature writing throughout Maroons. Are you a naturalist? Are you a man of the woods and the Great Plains and all of that?
Oh yeah, I've been hunting most of my life, and there's a connection when you hunt. Mm-hmm. If you really hunt, we used to say that the degree of success in hunting is equal to the amount that you suffer. when you get up early in the morning, I mean, way before the break of dawn, you go out and it is cold, bone chilling cold, and sit there and try to be quiet for hours. Okay. But you listen and you hear everything.
Yeah.
And I could tell you a lot of stories. I have seen moose combating bull moose.
Wow.
In a meadow in front of me.
Wow.
And they didn't know I was there. I have had a coyote walk right up behind me.
Good grief.
I mean, wow. There's something about that connection. Now, you know, I'm not talking about driving down the road, shooting out the window. I'm talking about hunting.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And when you learn the smells, I knew when I could smell an elk, the safety went off immediately. I knew that I was that close.
I'll be damned. Wow. Wow.
So
that explains it, Randy. That explains your very vivid nature writing, I must say. That's an added bonus, listeners. If you love nature writing, you're going to get some really beautiful words in these books. Randy, by the way, I'm going to mention to our listeners that you're coming to us from one of the most beautiful parts in the world, North America, for sure. And that's Western South Dakota. I would include Western North Dakota in that. I'm a North Dakota boy. But the Western Dakotas are gorgeous, and you have a privileged view of nature out there. That's for sure, don't you?
Indeed, indeed, you are exactly right, Dave. I feel so blessed to be here.
Yeah, it's a special, special place. See, Randy, I also know that you're a Mason by craft, by profession, and I want to ask you about the parallels, if there are any, because I was thinking about this. I used to work in the concrete business, precast concrete business. So I'm pretty good with a trowel, but that's as far as my building goes. But I was thinking about crafting a story, building a world, which is in effect what you have done, and building itself as a Mason. Do you ever think about that connection? What you do with your hands, what you do with your fingers when you type?
I think it's a huge connection, Dave. I mean, masonry is such an old trade, perhaps one of the oldest, and it's vanishing, and but there's something about masonry when you're done looking at what you built, knowing that, my God, that's probably going to outlive me and maybe even my children, my children's children. And masonry is particularly brick. I mean, stone is one and block, but brick is such a methodical, repetitive, and you just get in a rhythm.
Yeah.
And the day would just fly by. I mean, I did it for 35 years, Dave. Wow. And I love going to work every goddamn day.
That's beautiful. And it's not work at all.
Yeah, no. And a lucky man is a man who loves to go to work.
Yes.
And yes. I did.
That's, I love that. I love it. Yeah, I love it. And building something that lasts forever, that's true of stories too. Right?
Yeah, yeah. And you meet the most interesting people in the mission. It takes a certain type to be amazed. It really does. And
I could talk about this, but we're supposed to talk about your book. So we got a few minutes left. I want to keep doing this. Speaking of stories that last forever, at the end of the first volume, a human epic. There is a murder. And it reminded me of the Cain and Abel story in Genesis. To what degree did some of these old, and I'll call them myths, various religious myths and these legends or whatever you want to call them, I don't mean to offend anyone, but there's a lot of stories. Many cultures have their stories. To what degree did these influence your storytelling, these old stories?
Oh, well, I mean, I grew up in a very conservative Christian household.
Yeah.
So the Bible is gonna show up in there somehow. Yep. And you're right. I think I even used the name Abel.
You did.
And it is very much like that. However, it wasn't about God. It was about love and sex and romance and being with the wrong person or whatever you want to call it.
Yep.
And it was about betrayal. It was about it was all those things.
Yeah.
And that's one thing about the Bible. I mean, particularly the Old Testament.
Yeah.
It tells you the dirt about people.
Yeah.
My nickname Uriah. That's my favorite story of the Bible. It shows the duplicity of the Bible. Because here's this
story. Tell us the story. Go ahead.
The telling of Uriah?
Yes.
Uriah was the husband of Bathsheba. He was one of David, King David, who was the man after God's own heart. And he was one of David's most faithful and loyal soldiers. And when Dave was back in town and his army was out in the field, he sees Uriah's wife bathing on the rooftop.
Yeah.
Calls for, has sex with her, impregnates her. And so to hide this, he calls Uriah back from the field and he's hoping that he'll sleep with his wife and he'll never know. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't. He won't go in the house. And he calls him to him. He says, why don't you sleep with your wife? And he says, my men are in the field. How can I do that when my men are in the field? I mean, basically it was shameful.
Yeah.
For David, the way. And so David sends him back with his own note that he never reads, but he carries it to the general and says, I want you to put Uriah out front on the next attack. And then I want you to pull back so that he gets killed.
I remember that story now. My goodness.
And then, and so he does. And David never suffers the consequences for that sin. He's the man after God's own heart. And I chose the name, nickname Uriah, because I love that guy.
Yeah.
You know, he was loyal. He was good. He was faithful. He was honest.
Yep.
He was brave.
Yep.
And what did he get for it?
Yep. I hear you. Well, I love that story. And thanks for reminding me of it. And I always think of Uriah Heep when I hear of Uriah. And it begins with the Dickens character in David Copperfield. And then, of course, became the rock band.
Who is also a nefarious character. The Dickens guy.
Indeed. Yes, that was. Uriah Heep and Dickens was a nefarious character. That's right. And the rock band, I guess, was nefarious too. I don't know. But I used to love
them. People love their music. Yeah,
I did.
People still listen to it. Yeah.
Yeah, I did. I did. Anyway, we're off track there a little bit. A lot of it, probably. Randy, let's circle back to the stories. And why don't you tell us, as we roll out of here, about the third volume. And without giving too much away, you told us about the first. You gave us a sense for what's going on in the second volume. What's the big theme of number three?
The big theme, the name of number three is miscegenation. I split it in half, so it's miscegenation. Yep. Now, miscegenation means the mixing of the races.
Yep.
Now, that was bound to happen because there's not that many people. So if you're going to repopulate, you're all going to have to get mixed up. And that's probably a good thing.
Yes.
But it's a little bit deeper than that. In the third book, the groups that know about each other up to this point in time are starting to gather together and form larger groups and what have you. But there's another segment of society that's a result of the virus that are descendants from, I don't want to go into too much,
sure.
they're different. They're different. They're genetically different and not different and physically.
Okay.
But they have that this virus has jump-started an evolutionary jump to where they can use their minds far better than we can. In other words, do you want me to tell you?
Well, you're teasing us pretty well. That's pretty good. You don't have to give everything away, but.
Part of this third book is not just the mixing of the races and the mixing of people. It's a mixing of these people that have evolved.
Gotcha.
With the people that are stuck in the way that we are.
Gotcha. Nice.
I mean, let me just throw this out at you.
Yep.
Imagine a world where you couldn't lie anymore.
Wow.
How would you deal with that? I mean, if you could tell when someone was lying and they could tell if you were lying, that's cool, right? I mean, because everybody, you know, what about you around somebody who could tell if you were lying?
Yeah.
But you couldn't tell if they were lying.
Oof. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, you got me interested. I'll tell you that much. I want to remind our listeners, we are speaking with Randy Lou Allen, Lullin, author of the trilogy Maroons, first volume, A Human Epic, second volume, The Journey, third volume coming out later this year, early next year, Miscegenation Nation. Randy, what a pleasure to talk to you again. And for all you listeners, this is our second visit. We chatted live with Randy. It was quite an experience. We had a blast, but we wanted to do it one more time for posterity's sake. Randy, what a treat to have you.
Yeah, it was. This went awfully fast. Are we done with it already?
Yeah, isn't that something? We're actually a little over time, and hopefully, I don't think they're, I won't let them cut a second of it. These always go so fast, Randy. It's just amazing. But I'm really glad we got to introduce people to your good work and to your good stories and to you yourself.
Well, thank you, David. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Absolutely. You've been listening to Right on Radio. I'm Dave Fettig, and we were speaking with Randy Lou Allen. And now this.
Robert, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Cool. Why don't you start by giving us a synopsis of the book, just very brief, and then the reading that you have planned.
Okay. The World Played Chess is a coming-of-age story about a young man named Vincent, who is currently a father of an 18-year-old boy who's preparing to go off to college when he receives a journal in the mail. And the journal is from a gentleman that Vincent worked with in 1979 when he had graduated from high school and was preparing to leave for college. The gentleman's name was William. And William, in 1979, was going through PTSD. He's a Vietnam vet. The two guys that Vincent worked with were both Vietnam vets. William is going through PTSD, and he begins to deteriorate throughout the summer. So the journal is sort of William's explanation of what happened in that summer of 1979. And it's the story of his year-long tour in Vietnam. And Vincent uses that experience and what he learned from that experience to help prepare his son to move on to college.
Okay, why don't you do the reading then?
Sure, and you wanted about 3 to 5 minutes? And
3 to 5 minutes,
that?
Yeah. Closer to three than five.
All right, sounds good. Prologue. A purpose I have learned is rarely found, but revealed. Only when I do not search does the purpose become clear. So it would be with William Goodman's journal. I had no idea why he sent it to me, but his purpose would reveal itself in time. William mailed the journal he kept in Vietnam in a 5x8 manila envelope addressed simply to Vincenzo, without my last name, Bianco. Scrawled in blue ink, the crude numbers and letters appeared rushed, as if William had quickly written the name and my Burlingame address, perhaps worried he might change his mind before he mailed the envelope. He did not provide his name or return address, but I knew the sender. I had not heard that version of my name in nearly 40 years, nor had I seen or spoken with the only person who had routinely used it. William's package arrived on a Saturday via regular mail, with 8 American flag postage stamps in the upper right corner. That caught my attention. I opened the envelope with more than a little curiosity, and I pulled out a rectangular Tiger chewing tobacco tin, the orange and gold leaf scratched and aged and in the four corners, one of which had a dent, displaying flakes of rust. I held the tin like a religious relic, uncertain what it could possibly contain or if I wanted to open it. After a moment of contemplation, I popped the lid. Beneath a folded sheet of paper, the kind once kept by a telephone to scribble hurried notes and phone numbers, I found a 3x5-inch black hardcover notebook, the lined sheets filled with the same harsh handwriting as on the envelope. I unfolded the sheet and noted an illustration of a birdhouse with an American flag above the round entry hole. Again, it seemed as incongruous with the William I had known as the patriotic stamps. The note, however, was vintage William, humor, with a seriousness lurking beneath his words. Vincenzo, look what I found in a box in my storage closet. I guess it wasn't in the box I threw out with my medals and ribbons after all. Fate, perhaps. I was uncertain what to do with it. My wife is gone now. Cancer took her. She had a daughter from a previous marriage who, for all intents and purposes, I raised as my own. But I cannot give this to her. She wouldn't understand. It's just me now, a squad of one. I almost threw it out. Then I thought of you. I thought of that summer, 1979. You asked about Vietnam, and you listened when others did not. You saved me from destroying my life, and you were the reason I found my life again. I don't think you knew that. I never had the chance to tell you. I should have. I believe we both dreamed of being journalists. I see on the internet you're a successful lawyer. Dreams are hard to catch, aren't they? I didn't obtain my dream either. Not that one, anyway. But I achieved so many others I never thought possible. I have no regrets, and I certainly won't complain. Every minute of every day is a gift, and growing old a privilege, not a right. I lowered William's letter and recalled... You want me to stop there?
Yeah, why don't we stop there? That seems like a good place to stop. Growing old is a privilege, not a right. That's a big part of this book, one of the themes that runs through it. I want to start, though, by talking about big generalities. I feel at my age, and perhaps your age too, we're the last generation that experienced the war as a live thing going on. And I'm wondering, you know, how do you feel about that, what that means to you, and also why you chose to write about this era?
Well, I chose to write about the era because, you know, I did live through this. I did go to work my senior year in high school. I graduated from high school, and that summer I went to work with 2 Vietnam veterans on a construction crew. And a lot of what happened that summer is true. I learned a tremendous amount from them. I grew up in Burlingame, California in the 1960s, which was in a bubble. It was a bucolic childhood with kids, you know, delivering papers on their bikes, and we'd grab our bats and baseballs and we'd go play down at the park, and, you know, there was no crime and everything was wonderful. And then at 18 years of age, I go to work with two guys who are still young, you know, they're late 20s, early 30s, and they experienced something completely and totally different. So I remember hearing the news at night and the casualties on the TV screen. And for whatever reason, probably because of that summer, Vietnam fascinated me. And I found myself, you know, I bought a book by Mark Baker called Nam, and it first came out in the 1970s, maybe it was the early 80s. And I bought that book and read it. I still have the first edition here on the shelf. It was one of the books I read when I was doing my research. And, you know, I think what you said is very true. It was a war it was the first war to really come into the American household. It was televised. There were reporters embedded with troops. And we got to see for the first time young men dying. We weren't. You know, it wasn't the guns of Navarone or the Dirty Dozen. were the war movies that were out there that I used to watch with my dad, where the Americans always came home and they were always heroes and everything was wonderful. This was reality, and young men were dying. They were losing their lives over there. So it was a war that a very real war for a lot of Americans, male and female, mothers and fathers, housewives, you name it. And it was one of those pivotal moments in U.S. history that, you know, life changed. The protests that came about after and everything, it was like 9/11. You know, it changed the world for a lot of people. Kennedy's assassination was in 61. There was just a whole bunch of turmoil going on during that period of time. So for me as an author, it was a time period that was really rich with potential characters and stories.
Your characters are quite vivid, and especially William. I find him to be very vivid. Obviously, we're reading his journal, so it's kind of intense to read that journal. And I read in the publicity material that some of these characters have a touch of you, really in all the characters. And I'm wondering if you talk about William as a character, and especially PTSD, since they didn't know much about that then, and also how it goes with you.
Sure. So when I went to work on the construction crew in 1979, there was a gentleman there who I called William, and he was a very, when I first started there, he was just very gregarious, outgoing. He did call me Vincenzo, even though my name is Robert. My middle name is Vincent. And I played softball with him, and I worked with him, and he was a friend of my brother-in-law's. And as the summer progressed, he began to change. You could see it in his physicality. You could see it in his emotional composition. You could see it in the way he responded to things. I can recall a moment in time when his El Camino was filled with clothes, and I found out he'd been kicked out of the house by his girlfriend. He drank a lot. He did a lot of drugs. He was a man in pain, but he was also just a great guy. And, you know, it was hard for me to reconcile the distinction between this great guy who was so much fun to be around and play softball with, and this guy that had so many problems, obvious problems. You know, things were difficult and problematic. So when I was putting the book together, like anything, you know, one of the really beautiful parts about being an author is you get to play the parts. And so I was never given a Vietnam War journal by this man. And it was actually something that was recommended to me by my son, who's now 23 years old. He said, you know, I don't know what happened in Vietnam. I know about Vietnam, but I don't know what happened on a personal level to the soldiers that were over there. And I think it would be a really interesting to find out what happened to William so we could understand why he is the way he is in 1979. So that required that I go do a lot more research. And as I said, I was always fascinated by Vietnam, and I had some books, and I went out and bought more and more and more. And I just read and read and read. And I, you know, I kept reading, and I kept watching the movies, and I kept watching the documentaries, and I kept talking to a couple of men who had served in Vietnam, who became sort of my baseline on making sure things were accurate, where the Marines were located, what fire bases, and all those kinds of things. And so then I reached the point where, you know, I had to put together William's experience, and I had to put it together in a way that showed the progression of what he went through and the difficulties he went through, which was going to be symbiotic with the difficulties that he was experiencing in 1979 as his personality began to change. So, you know, William, the character of William is based on a true character, but he's fictional because, you know, his experience in Vietnam was one that I was able to make up using a lot of firsthand accounts from the young men that had served over there and found the courage to come back and write about it. And then, you know, I'm a dad of a son that went off to college, and before he went off, he played football. And he was a good football player, a very good football player. And in his senior year of high school, a young man that he had played with the year before, who was in his freshman year of college, died tragically in a just a tragic accident. And it was really, I think, one of those moments that my son will always remember, because it's that same moment of realization that all young people have when we first realize that we're not invulnerable, that, you know, our time on this earth is not guaranteed, and that it's a privilege, it's not a right. And so so a lot of the basis, the MacGuffins, if you will, were based upon, you know, true story that I went through and that my son went through and that we went through together when we, you know, had to go to this young man's funeral, et cetera.
We're speaking with Robert Dugnani about his book, The World Played Chess. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the title? Where does that come from?
Yeah, so that's interesting. You know, I didn't have a title for quite a while. And I was invited down to Palm Springs by a good friend of mine, Dale Walker. And I was telling Dale asked me, you know, what I was working on. And I was telling Dale, and then I got done, Dale said to me, it's like that adage, isn't it? The world played chess while I played checkers. Mm-hmm. And I said, what do you mean? I've never heard that. And he said to me, he goes, there's that adage, you know, the world played chess while I played checkers. Sometimes we're so far removed from the game that we don't even know what game they're playing. And our experience is so different from the experience that they experienced that, you know, we're not even in the same arena. We're not even in the same place. And I just thought it was brilliant. It was exactly what the book was about. You know, I couldn't even comprehend what mostly young men, what these young men went through when they went through the bush. I mean, you know, one moment they were 18 years old, they were graduating from high school, and 6 months later, they were being shipped out to Vietnam to fight a war that they had really no beef with the Vietnamese people. They had, you know, there was nothing, you know, heroic about going. It wasn't like World War II where we were, you know, fighting the Nazis and things like that. So it was just a really poignant adage that Dale told me, and my publisher loved it, and we were fortunate enough to be able to keep it.
This book must have been awfully intense to write. The word that comes into my mind, because I'm a child of the 60s, is heavy. It's a heavy book to write. I couldn't put it down. I finished it at 4 o'clock in the morning one morning, it was intense. And I'm wondering what it was like to write it, what you went through mentally and emotionally and spiritually to write this book.
It was intense. It was intense when I wrote it, and I wanted it to be intense because when I read all the firsthand accounts and the journals and the books that were written by a lot of these young men, it was very difficult for them to write their experience. Most Vietnam vets don't want to talk about their experience. I had several turn me down. They did not want to go back there. And I was fortunate that I had a couple that would. And so I wanted it to be intense because it was an intense experience. It was what they went through, you know, every day became intense and they had to deal with it. And so, you know, my hope was that I would provide the reader with sort of an experience that would put them, you know, on that same edge. You know, for me, I learned so much that summer, and then going back to it, you know, made me realize that I think it made me a better person, a better father, for instance. I have a much greater appreciation for my children, and you know, when they go through their experiences, I'm able to put them in a you know, to understand them. So, you know, for instance, we've all gone through a very difficult time with COVID. You know, some people have lost, you know, spouses and parents and siblings and friends, and it's been a very difficult time. And I think it's been and then they couldn't even get a chance to say goodbye. You know, they couldn't even have a funeral, and that's what these young men went through. These young men lost, you know, they lost friends, and you know, one minute they're standing by them, and the next minute they're gone, and they never even got the chance to say goodbye. They're just gone, and they're told to move on. They got to keep going forward. You know, how does one do that? It's just a very difficult thing to ask of us. And so, you know, for me, when we were going through the COVID crisis, you know, it was something that I could really relate to what these young men, what William went through, in Vietnam. And at the same time, I can remember when I talked to one of my Marine contacts, Bob Mangan, you know, and I was telling him, I feel really bad for my son and my daughter. You know, they had to come home. They're living at home with the parents. They're not enjoying school. They, you know, all their friends. And Bob said to me at the time, he said, always remember though, Bob, you're talking about 3 or 4 months. What we went through in Vietnam was 13 months, and it was every day. Every day we saw men, you know, young boys die. And every day we had to deal with, you know, getting up, moving out, moving forward. We had days that we felt like we were doing absolutely nothing. And then one minute, you know, all hell would break loose. So, you know, for me, it was just sort of a very poignant time in our current history to be writing the book. And there was a great deal of emotion for me when I was, you know, pouring through the writing it. It was, I did the narration, and I didn't do the journal. They hired an actor to do the journal. And yeah, I was really glad that they did, because, you know, I can do a New Jersey accent. I can do that and everything. But, you know, I had to do the parts where William and Vincent are talking in the novel. And it was, you know, we would get through a scene and I'd have to take a break. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd have to go outside, because it was that emotionally difficult at times.
Talk a little bit more in the book. I'm trying to decide which thing to talk about here. Let's talk about luck and fate, because that gets more and more important as the book goes along. And you have some things in the book to say about luck and fate.
Yeah. You know, I can remember sitting in the garage after a day of work, sitting on a white bucket, and Jerry we'd start talking. And there were things. I worked with the other gentleman for longer than a summer. I worked with him for multiple summers and multiple breaks, and he helped me raise enough money to put myself through Stanford. So, you know, a lot of this was things that I learned, not just that summer, but subsequent summers. And what I started to learn was these two gentlemen were very similar. There was a lot of similarities, and the similarities were things like they lived day to day. They didn't think about the future. You know, they got paid, they went out, they had a good time with the money that they earned. And then they got paid the next week, they went out, they had a good time with the money they earned. They didn't believe in God, neither of them. And they both said basically the same type of thing. They said, when I needed God, he wasn't there, so I'll get through it on my own. Things like that. They had sort of this temper that could just flare. And they were afraid of no one or nothing. It was almost as if they didn't care. And it was, you know, the similarities ran through them. And I can remember talking to William, you know, in that garage. And I can remember him saying to me, you know, you can believe in fate, but it's really just luck, you know, good luck and bad luck. And some people have bad luck. And, you know, why am I here and other people aren't? It's just luck. He didn't see it as any type of ordination that he was supposed to go on and do something great with his life, or that God had spared him because he was going to do something, you know, brilliant. He just saw it as luck. And, you know, you could understand what he was talking about when you listen to the stories that he told about Vietnam. You know, the guy in front of him would step on a bouncing Betty. And if he hadn't stepped on it, William would have stepped on it, or the guy behind him would have stepped on it, you know, and is that fate? They didn't think so. He said it was luck, you know, it was just luck, bad luck, good luck.
We've been speaking with Robert Dugoni, how do you pronounce your last name?
Dugoni,
about his book, The World Played Chess. I wish we had more time, but we do not. I really appreciate your coming on the air, and also your flexibility. We had a little bit of a time issue, and I appreciate your flexibility coming on a half hour later than we thought you would come on. And I really appreciate your honesty. I love the book. It is very intense, but it's very important for those of us who lived through the 60s, and also those of us who didn't, to learn what that was all about. So thank you very much, Robert. We really appreciate you being on Right on Radio.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. It's been a privilege.
Oh, great. Well, it's been a privilege to have you for us, too. And we'll let you go. Thanks a lot. And now this.
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming on live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. I'd like to thank our special guests tonight, Randy Lalin and Robert Dugani, plus our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at KFAI.org/program/Right on Radio. Plus, listen to decent recent episodes, and they're decent, I think. They're all right. On our recently launched podcast, found on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcast, and anywhere podcasts can be found. Now stay tuned to Bonjour, Minnesota.
We gotta clean up.